Hi, I'm Patrick McEnroe, and I'm honored to be the president of the International Tennis Hall of Fame. And it's with great pleasure to welcome you to another of our Tennis Worthy podcasts. Our theme for this month is dedication. And in this podcast, the writer, broadcaster, and tennis historian Chris Bowers has picked out three legends of the sport who were promising figures, but had to wait a lot longer than most people expected to achieve their major goal in tennis. And for a couple of them, it came when many thought it would never happen. Take it away, Chris.
In the early years of open tennis, the biggest names in the women's game were Margaret Court, Billie Jean King, and then Chris Evert and Martina Navratilova. But competing with them was Virginia Wade, who in the 1970s carried the hopes of her native Great Britain whenever Wimbledon came round. Yet every year she seemed to blow it. Wade was the daughter of an itinerant Anglican bishop who was posted to South Africa when she was 1 year old. Yet when she first picked up a racket, her determination was already evident.
You know, I started to play tennis when the family lived in South Africa, so it was a pretty popular sport there. And I started when I was only when I was nine, but you know, they didn't really have any little rackets then, so you had to deal with a great big heavy racket. But once I'd always played ball sports, and once I played tennis, I just didn't want to do anything else but play tennis. I drove everybody crazy trying to get them to play with me. So I was obviously obsessed with it from a very early age. We moved back to England when I was about 15 and a half, and this was where England was, where all the tennis, international tennis was going on. There were tournaments all over the place, of course, Wimbledon, and Wimbledon was the ultimate famous place. So it was a pretty good place to be in those days. And so although I was at school and then I went to university, I was just desperate to play tennis the whole time. And, I wasn't being pushed by a parent or a coach. So it was all coming from me, from inside of me. So that dedication and the determination was something that just went hand in hand with my life. Although tennis didn't go open until I played full time for a couple of years. So I was in that cross section of the generations of the eras. And it was sort of interesting. I mean, I think if tennis had been if I had been a little bit later in an era where there was more professionalism, more coaching available, more application, I think I would have benefited from that. However, I was that's what I want, what I enjoyed doing. I was really wanted to play and I really wanted to win, but I wasn't, when I say I was obsessed about playing, I wasn't necessarily obsessed about winning, but I was just loved the game.
Despite not doing herself justice at Wimbledon, Wade was a Grand Slam singles champion very early in her career. She won the first ever US Open in 1968 and followed it up 3 years later with the Australian Open title. But the big difference between those two tournaments and Wimbledon was that she didn't have the distractions of it being her home major. And Wade says that was a crucial factor in her success overseas.
For an English player, Wimbledon is just the ultimate. But it also comes with its difficulties. You always have your friends around and people you know, and it's quite distracting. So it's quite hard to just put your blinkers on and focus on that. So when I won the US Open, it was the second year after I was playing full-time, because I went to university when I was, I guess, 18, finished just when I was 21. I mean, I was playing whenever I could, but I didn't play full-time till after that. So the US Open was lovely because, you know, there wasn't anybody there to just distract you, and you just got on with what you had to do, and it just so happened that I played a really, really good tournament. I just was playing really well that particular tournament in 1968. Again, there was motivation because it was the first time that it was the Open tournament, and so I won the US Open in 1968. I felt a lot of pressure after that. I played out of my mind, but I didn't know what I was doing really then. And you do have the feeling that everybody's after you and wants to beat you. And then I never know whether it was 72 or it was 71, that tournament. It was the Australians changed their time slot a bit, but I think it was New Year's Day in Melbourne in 1972. And I had to play Yvonne Coulagon. And it was really difficult playing her. Sometimes she would be unbelievable. Other times she just would, you wouldn't have a problem with her. And because it was New Year's Day, I know I had been partying to a certain extent the night before, certainly had a couple of glasses of champagne. So I think what that did for me was made me a little guilty the day that I played her. So I had to really concentrate. So I put all my energy into concentrating that match, and I played well. So that was something. And then it was sporadic, my success.
So by the start of 1972, Wade was a two-time major singles champion and three times a women's doubles runner-up. But despite having a big serve, good slice, and an ideal game for grass, she'd yet to get beyond the fourth round at Wimbledon. And as she said there, her results were sporadic. She reached her first Wimbledon semi-final in 1974, but after winning the first set 6-1, she was out-psyched by her doubles partner Olga Morozova and by rain delays. But from 1975, she put a lot more effort into her training, something she credits to her first ever tour coach and the discipline needed to survive in world team tennis, which for 6 years in the 1970s was an integral part of the professional tennis year.
From 75 on, I think I was much more professional. I'd been playing team tennis and I was playing for New York. And so we had that discipline with people around us in the team that you practice with all the time. And I worked really, really hard. And I think I was the fittest I'd ever been, although I always thought I was pretty fit. For that era, I mean, I was quick, I was as fit as I could be, but, you know, I don't think I'd hold a candle to these players now, especially the big, strong ones. So anyway, I was much more professional, and I was taking every match one at a time, and then I'd actually, you know, most of the time I'd had nobody coaching me at all, and from this earlier in that year, I'd worked with Jerry Teagarden, who was Pam Teagarden's father, who was another player. Basically, what he did for me was stop me panicking in the middle of the tournament. There's such a tendency for a tennis player to think, you know, what happened? I can't hit my forehand, I can't hit my backhand. And, you know, so you need somebody to say, you know, technically everything is perfect, or just hit it a little earlier, or stay with, or something very simple. So he was very good at that. But I was definitely had a reputation for being temperamental, but that was one of my big hang-ups. So once I realized that, you know, it was just showing my insecurity rather than being a necessity to do that, I just totally got over that, finally. It took a while, but finally. And, you know, if you wanted to show your... I found ways of showing my frustration or even anger in a very less destructive way. So it... Those things take a while. You know, there weren't any things like sports psychologists around then. You know, everybody gets tense. The top players get just as tense as the lesser players, although the lesser players don't want to think that. But everybody gets tense. So in the end, it's the balance of motivation which has to override the tension. So, you know, if you out there and you just tense and you know, it overwhelms you, that's when you start losing. So you have to really always fight to see the light at the end of the tunnel, whatever happens. And I got better at that.
Wade made it to another Wimbledon semi-final in 1976, but lost it to an inspired Yvonne Goolagong-Cawley. But at the start of 77, Wade was no longer the top British player. At the end of 76, Sue Barker was ahead of Wade in the world rankings and had picked up that year's Roland Garros title. That took the pressure off Wade and was just one of several factors that convinced her that 1977 could finally be her year.
I think by 77, they still thought I had a chance, but I think they'd given up on me, really. 2 years prior, I had had a fantastic Wimbledon. I played really, really well, and I played Yvonne Goolagong. And it was one of those matches where you come off the court and you say, well, I did absolutely everything I could, and I lost. So, you know, I had thought I'd been ready to win Wimbledon a couple of years before. I needed everything to go right. The other thing that really helped me was that we finally had another British player since Sue Barker, who was playing really well that year. So I think that, talking about the media and the expectations, that deflected the pressure off me. When I was thinking about Wimbledon in 1977, I thought to myself, boy, you know, at this stage of my career, and I have never really played as well as I should at Wimbledon. And then I found out that the Queen was going to be there. So that was sort of just made everything gel. I don't know if it's possible to explain what the Queen meant to English people, especially years ago. I mean, I think everybody just thought she was amazing, and she didn't like tennis. We knew that. She liked horse racing, and she was attentive to other sports. But, you know, to have her there when she'd never been there, you think, well, better show her what tennis, the value of tennis, the values of tennis. And then it was, not only was it the centenary of Wimbledon, but it was the Queen's Silver Jubilee. The Silver Jubilee had celebrations everywhere, a lot of street fairs and street parties and flags. And I don't know, the 70s were a fairly depressing era, really, in England. So I think that Queen's Jubilee really lifted people's spirits enormously. So if the Queen's going to be there, I better be there on finals day. And if I'm going to be there on finals day, I better win the tournament, because I'll never get another chance.
And so to the Centenary Wimbledon Championships. On the opening day, there was a parade of past champions that signalled the historical gravitas of the event. Maria Bueno and Billie Jean King came out of retirement to compete. A 14-year-old Tracy Austin made her Wimbledon debut and ended up playing the world number one Chris Evert on centre court. And in the background were the two home hopes of a singles title, Wade and Barker. Both reached the semi-finals, creating the prospect of an all-British final. In the first semi, Wade played arguably her best ever match against Evert, beating her in three sets. But then Barker succumbed to nerves against Betty Stover, leaving Wade to face Stover in front of Queen Elizabeth in what became a national festival.
We played the final on a Friday in those days, and the men played on the Saturday because they didn't play on Sundays. It was a beautiful day. It was the 1st of July, and we saw the Queen coming in, and she was dressed in the same colour, pink, old rose as my outfit was, which Ted Tinling had made all these fabulous, and I had this cashmere cardigan with my initials in it, and then the same dress I'd been washing out every night because it was obviously doing good things for me. So there was tremendous, it was very festive, the whole atmosphere. Papers were all agog, and you then hear the number of people who afterwards say, oh, we were at school, but we had no classes because they gave us a television to watch the final. So it was big. It was a tremendous atmosphere. But I did go on and sneak onto the court before and just get the atmosphere, and the band was playing. And so, you know, so I had good visualization. And then you just are going to visualize. And, you know, walking on, I mean, there was no question who the crowd was for. They were extremely biased. And I didn't mind that. You know, sometimes that's pressure. And either you go with it or you sunk. Betty was, she was always tough to play. Look, she was tall, big serve. She didn't give you any rhythm at all. So I was prepared for anything to go wrong. So that went wrong that first set. But then I got ahead right at the beginning of the second set. I guess the only time I didn't feel that comfortable was at 3-all in the second set, because the momentum had changed in the set, but then I lost my serve or something. But then from then on, I just was in the zone, as they always say in tennis, and I just couldn't do anything wrong. So from there, it just went gangbusters, and it was it's quite exciting to play when you know nothing, when you can't do anything wrong. Like in the last game, I was so on such a high, basically, and I clocked this forehand down the line into a forehand, and I think it was a winner, and then it was complete bedlam out there. There was so much noise, and I so often, I think that, you know, the great thing about my tennis was I had my biggest success when I was a little bit older, because if you have all your success at the beginning and then it's not so good, then you just, you know, it sort of wanes your memory of it. You're not left with the best memories, but I was certainly left with the best memory. It was worth waiting for.
Wade's dedication had enabled her to reach the prize she always craved. And as she walked to the net, Betty Stover put her fingers in her ears to block out the bedlam. And the poet and BBC radio commentator Max Robertson finished his call of the match with the words, "And Virginia will take tea with the Queen." It was a piece of fiction. Wade never took tea with Queen Elizabeth. But it seemed to sum up her personal triumph in the summer of 77, when the British turned their minds away from some harsh economics. Many a competitor has been burdened with the tag, the best player never to win a Grand Slam title. And for the 3 years between his third defeat in a Wimbledon final and his glorious Monday victory, Goran Ivanišević carried that tag. But his dedication, in particular bouncing back from a bout of personal indiscipline, brought him to the promised land. Ivanišević freely admits he was lucky in where fate chose to place him, not just near an impressive tennis club, but even in the street in which he lived as a child.
All began in, 71 I was born, but all this road began in 1978. That was, back then was Yugoslavia, small club in Split. And this club is unique because it's there is no club in the world, I can say, that gave four top 10 players. Actually, we all grew up in the same street. Nikola Pilić, Željko Franojević, Mario Ančić and me. Hardly you can find a country with the four top 10 players. And imagine small city of 250,000 people, one street, 10 courts for top 10 guys. It's it's unbelievable achievement. I started, you know, together soccer and tennis, you know, because Split is well known by Hajduk Split. It's our proud of city, the football club. So, you know, or every kid wants to be a football player and play for Hajduk. But somehow we live close to the tennis. My father was a club player, nothing spectacular. And I decided, he took me one day to play. Actually, he went to play, I went with him. So he gave me the racket to hit next to the wall. And I think when I broke the first racket, first time I came to the tennis, I broke the racket. I showed the talent even then. Probably I saw somebody and my father came and he said, "What happened with the racket?" I say, "I don't know, I just broke it." So somehow I started to like tennis.
Having a talented son was not always easy for the Ivanišević family. The young man was, well, somewhat temperamental, especially in his early teens. But at that point, his father, surgeon, made a major sacrifice for his son's tennis career.
But he was very involved, you know. He was professor in the university. And I remember the day when, you know, I was 14, I finished the primary school. I was, so then I had to go to high school. So my mother is also chemist engineer, my father, everybody, also my sister. So they didn't know what to do, you know. I was very good, but, you know, with 14, you know, we didn't have money, so they had to decide, should I go to school or should I quit the school and kind of go part-time and play tennis more. So father had to decide. And father said to me, I remember, he quit his job. You are more talented in tennis than I was ever a professor in the university. So he really put all the effort. Mom was still working, but father was, you know, there. Father was actually main figure in my road. Father was there on a day basis every day.
The gamble paid off. By the time Ivanišević was 16, he'd earned the chance to play in the Wimbledon qualifying tournament. It was to be the start of an obsession and a love affair with the world's premier grass court tournament. But he'd never played on the surface. And while he was by then on the books of a management company, he seemed to lack practical support. So this 16-year-old boy from Split was packed off to travel to London on his own, where he ended up profiting from the help of Yugoslavia's then top player, the former semi-finalist Slobodan Zivojinovic. Ivanišević tells the story of his first Wimbledon.
Qualifying was in the Royal Hampton. You have 30 courts. And I came alone. Father sent me with the money, said, okay, you go alone. IMG put me in some terrible hotel. So I had some money to spend for the food. But first day I made mistake. I took a wrong tube. I went to the completely wrong direction. So till I came back, I spent quite a bit of money that I had for the food. So I had to cut some, I didn't have lunch that day. And I was too shy to ask anybody to warm up with me. So I just sit down, waited for my match. I never step on the grass. So I won the first match. And then, nice thing happened there. Yugoslavian player, our best player, Bobo Živojinović, who was back then also superstar and good player. He saw me, said, what are you doing here alone? I say, I am alone. I'm playing qualies. I have nobody. Say, okay, come. So he invited me in his house. So finally I had a nice proper meals. He was, I stay close to the Royal Hampton. So his friend drove me to the course every day. And I won second round. And now the last round, it's best of five. I never played best of five in my life. And I qualified, I won in five sets, and I qualified for Wimbledon. That was like, wow. And also thanks to him, who really took me to his home, and really helped me a lot. Being there alone, kid from Yugoslavia, doesn't know anybody, anything. First day I came to Wimbledon, they opened that doors, and I was like, kind of Alice in the Wonderland, I was like just walking for 15 minutes. For me, it was everything, just walking through this no crowd, seeing those courts, seeing those center court, dreaming, okay, maybe one day I might play there. But my game was good for the grass. Grass back then was extremely fast. I had a huge serve. My return was good, so I like to come in. Generally, I didn't like to play on grass because grass was very fast and very unpredictable. But my game was good for grass. I knew that, so I said, okay, this is a tournament. You really have to focus. It's 2 weeks. Can be a lot of different, with the rain, you could stop. You never know, with the bad weather, you stop the match for 5-6 times, but you need to be focused for 2 weeks. And with my game, I could, I knew that I have a best chance there to win the tournament.
And so it proved. Just 2 years later, in 1990, the Croat reached the semi-finals. And a further 2 years on, he was a Wimbledon finalist and strong favourite to beat Andre Agassi, who was rewriting the grass court rulebook by playing from the baseline. Despite serving 37 aces, Ivanišević lost the final in five sets. But it was clear he would have more chances. 2 years later, he was back again, playing superbly against Boris Becker to reach his second Wimbledon final.
Actually, that was my best, if not the best, probably top three best matches in Wimbledon or in my life. I really played unbelievable. He didn't have any chance. Boris on grass. And I remember when we were shaking hands, he said, man, you're playing too good, you better win this tournament now. And then in the final, again, guy who probably ruined at least 20 years of my life, Mr. Sampras, I don't know. I didn't play bad, but he played good. He played better. You know, first two sets were close, 7-6, 7-6. Third set, 6-love. Not that I played badly. He was one step better somehow. And again, a huge disappointment. I was sure that I have a chance that I'm gonna win, but somehow I didn't manage. And again, all through your mind, you know, I have to answer the questions: why you lose? Are you gonna have another chance? Are you gonna have another chance? And I say, okay, yeah, I'm gonna have another chance if I stay focused. This is good surface for me. This is a good tournament for me, and there is no doubt that I'm gonna have a chance. And nobody can, you know, you have to play good tennis to beat me in three sets here in this tournament. So I had another chance next year when I lost to Pete again in the semifinals in five sets, which I thought that match I should have won. I had a better chance. I played better, but somehow these key points, he played better, and story repeated again and again, like deja vu. I still believe, you know, sometimes you're kind of doubting, but I still believe. I say, okay, it's nothing, you know, you are there, you know. And then 96, Krajicek won, and then the game, I say, come on, this is your tournament, this is, you know, it has to be. I had that picture in my dream that I hold a trophy. Cannot be that. It's not going to happen, you know. You know, when you have a clear picture, some dreams that I really dreamt happen, and there's such a clear picture of me holding the trophy that I said, oh, something has to be wrong there. And so I believed enough till 98, till I get another chance.
Despite playing what he described as his most mature tennis in 1998, it was again Sampras who thwarted Ivanišević in the final. It didn't help that his semi-final against Richard Krajicek went the distance. He still took Sampras to five sets, but the American finished more strongly, leaving Ivanišević again with the runner-up's plate.
That match killed me, really. After that match, I was never more disappointed and sad, and I didn't know what to do. And then my career somehow went down, because for sure I was sure that I'm gonna win the Wimbledon. I was playing well, I was feeling well, and again I was holding the plate, not the trophy. And my face in that final there was not looking well, and I said, this is, or somebody is testing me, or if I can still keep believing and doing it, or this is it. So I didn't know which one of these two it is.
The tag of best player never to win a major seemed to be sticking to Goran Ivanišević when he had a chaotic end to 2000 and start of 2001. He had to default from one tournament because he broke all three of the rackets he took with him. He then deliberately lost a qualifying match at the Australian Open after it took him ages to find the match court. He got ill in Dubai and only played the tournament because his first round opponent pulled out before he did. And his ranking wasn't high enough to get into Wimbledon. So unless he was given a wild card, he'd have to qualify. But as Wimbledon got closer, things began to click.
Actually, I had a good preparation. I stayed at home. I skipped all clay. I said, okay, I'm going to prepare. Nothing to lose. I went to play Queens, and I played terrible. I lost the first round against Cristiano Carati, Italian guy. But not that I lost, doesn't matter. But the way I lost, I'm playing really bad and trying really hard. And that day they were deciding about wildcards. So I say, I was hoping they didn't watch my match, because for sure they don't give me wildcards. But luckily, they probably didn't have eight British players to give wildcards. So I got one. And I went to Hertogenbosch to play tournament before. And then Head, which was funny, they sent me the new racket. They say it's the same racket, different color, but... So I tried the racket, was not the same. They sent me three rackets, so what should I do? I said, why not? Who cares? I cannot play worse than what I'm playing now. so I can play same or I can play better. So I took these three rackets. I won a round and I lost to Leighton Hewitt in the second round. So I went back and my sponsor Takini sent me three shirts. That's how they believe in me. Actually, nobody believed, let's be honest. Any normal person would not believe in me. And something on Saturday, I remember the practice on the Rangi. I practiced with my great friend Nenad Zimonjić, who was a number one double player in the world. And this racket what I play, Prestige, they had a sound when you hit the serve, special sound. And after so many years, I felt the sound again. And I was serving unbelievable. So I said to him, hey, Ziki, I'm serving good. He said, yeah, I didn't see you for past couple of years to serve like this. So we start the tournament Monday, playing the qualifier. Actually, I played a good match. Serving well, I felt actually very good. After a long time, I feel happy on the court. Second round, Moya, who was seeded. And every time, you know, they didn't even mention my name. So court 18, again, unbelievable match. I really played well. I beat Moya. And I remember the poor Moya, they gave him such a bad time on the press conference. How can you lose to Goran? So I won again. But then I started to believe that something big is going to happen. I could not say because they would think for sure they will lock me out in the loony bin. But I knew something is big going to happen.
Wins over Andy Roddick, Greg Ruzetsky, Marat Safin and Tim Henman, an impressive cast, left Ivanisevic in his fourth Wimbledon final. The match against Henman had seen the rain save the Croat. It came after Henman had just taken a 2-1 lead. They played the fourth set on Saturday and then, after further rain, the fifth set on Sunday, both of which Ivanisevic won. The man who'd received a wild card because he believed there weren't eight British players had beaten the top two home heroes and was now in a Monday final against Pat Rafter. With no pre-sold tickets, it was a totally different crowd, creating a carnival atmosphere. Twice Ivanisevic led by a set. Twice Rafter got back on level terms, setting up a fifth set with intense drama.
Fifth set was like kind of back and forward. And then I felt it at 7-0 that this is it. Somehow this is time, this is the time for the break. And I'm never going to forget them. 15-40 point. I was waiting for him to serve on my forehand. I already made the grip. I somehow knew. I say, if he serves to my forehand, I'm just going to smack the ball hard as I can, and that's it. If he goes to my backhand, he wins the point because I'm not going to even cover the backhand side. And he goes and serves the slowest serve to my forehand. I just swing and I hit the forehand winner, cross, break. Everybody's out of the chairs, out of the minds. And I'm sitting there and I say, okay, now. It's the first time ever I'm serving for the Wimbledon victory. This is it. This is your life. This is everything. I mean, last game was probably the craziest, most exciting, most nervous game I ever played in my life. Every point was nervous. I lost my serve, everything. Nothing was working well. I just said, okay, relax, try to put the serve in. He's also nervous. First match point, double fault. I said, okay. So second match point, double fault again. I said, come on. It's a problem. When I'm nervous, I can't hit slow. I need to hit fast as I can. So I said, okay. And then third one, I thought I hit a good volley. And then he hit the unbelievable lob. But not that he hit a good lob, I could not lift up. My legs were so heavy. I said to myself, jump. But I just, it's like 100 kilos each leg. So I said, okay, this is again some kind of science. Fourth match point, fourth final, this is it. And every time when I hit the first serve, he went to the wrong side. So second serve again, I'm thinking, okay, can't do double fault again. It would be ridiculous, three double faults. So just try somehow, but to put, and somehow I did put the first serve in. And when I saw the ball, and I'm running to the net, I just saw him. I don't see the ball. You know, it's like kind of I lost it. And then suddenly I hear people going crazy, ball in the net. I go down. It's just tough to describe the feelings, the moment. Unbelievable.
Among the people in Ivanisevic's box was his father, surgeon. He'd been warned not to get too excited as he had a heart condition. Watching his son win the Wimbledon title on a 9-7 fifth set was surely not what the cardiologists would have recommended. But this was the man who'd quit his job as a university professor to give his son's tennis career a chance. And here, finally, was the moment when both father's and son's dedication produced the achievement they both valued above all else. The same weekend that Ivanisevic was winning his memorable men's Wimbledon title, a diminutive player from Belgium was the runner-up in the women's singles. Justine Henin was remarkable not just for her size, but because she was one of the few women players to hit her aggressive backhand one-handed. She'd always done so, and that trademark stroke was part of an overall tennis makeup that she believed was innate. This was Henin responding to the question about when she first chose to dedicate herself to tennis.
It's very strange. I don't think there's a moment. It was like I have more the feeling that it was inside me when I was born. I had to do something special. I had to choose a life a little bit, yeah, not normal, a little bit probably exceptional or different. And I started to play tennis with my brothers and my father. They were playing tennis, and I followed them at 4 or 5 years old. I was behind them all the time. As soon as they finished their matches, to ask them to play with me. And when I was in my apartment, I was in my room. I was dreaming of winning the French Open, and I was doing like I was holding the trophy. And I was only 5 or 6, so I don't have the feeling there's one moment I decided, okay, that's going to be my whole life. I have the feeling it's been forever in my blood, and when I was born, it was my destiny. And yeah, I don't know why, but it's like this.
The youngest of four children, Henin started winning junior titles at an early age. Those who remember her from the early years describe a very different looking girl than the woman who ended up winning 7 Grand Slam singles titles and the Fed Cup. She seemed intensely shy, and with her short brown hair and thick glasses, there was something very studious about her. She may have had the desire and the sense of destiny, but did she have the dedication to make it all come true? She was not scared to voice her dream and was untroubled if people thought she was a bit weird.
That's a little bit my story. When I was a little girl, I was dreaming, and not only a lot of people believed that my dream would come true. When I was 6 or 7 or 9 years old, and I was telling everyone I want to be number one player in the world in tennis, they were looking at me and probably not saying, but thinking, wow, she's a little bit crazy, that girl. And I think it's very good to be crazy. And I think it's very important to live your dreams. Did someone tell me that? Probably. But I took the inspiration from the others, but I was also inspired by my motivation. Really deep inside, there was a strong motivation to do that. And I found the resources with the others, but I think I found a lot of resources inside of me. And that's what I keep also from my experience. It's that when you believe something very strongly, it's probably a big part of the way that you did. My parents have been a lot of support for me. They were driving me everywhere for my practices. And I remember something that my mom was telling me. She was telling me, because she was a teacher, so being good at school was very important. But when she was joining me to my practice, she was telling me, I know that you sacrifice a lot, so I asked you to do it 100%. If you decide this way, you have to do it 100%. And I remember that, because I think that she was right. When we choose a direction, it's very important to give everything you have to reach your goals.
Inspired by her own motivation, she won a junior tournament that brought with it not just a trophy, but two tickets to the women's singles final at Roland Garros. As it happened, that meant a chance to watch the idol she'd spent hours watching on television in the family home in the Belgian town of Rochefort, Steffi Graf.
My earliest memories watching tennis probably on TV would be the French Open. I was in my apartment in my little town in Belgium, and it was probably watching Steffi Graf on TV, that's for sure, at the French Open. The first time I could go in a Grand Slam, it was at Roland Garros, and I was 10 years old. And I could see the final, because I won the tournament in Belgium, and I by winning this tournament, I got two invitations to go and see the final. It was Steffi Graf and Monica Seles in 1992. And Steffi lost 8-6 in the third, I think. And I was so disappointed. But I told to my mom that was just beside me, one day I'll be on this court and I will win this tournament. And I was 10 years old. And it's a memory very still. It's like it was yesterday, because it was the beginning of my dream.
That trip proved to have added poignancy for Enna, because 2 years later, her mother died of cancer. In the aftermath, there were family ructions, but the rising star remained focused on her tennis. She teamed up with a Belgium-based Argentinian, Carlos Rodriguez, who became her lifelong coach. A couple of days after her 15th birthday, she won the girls' singles at Roland Garros. And at 19, she beat Jennifer Capriati at Wimbledon to reach her first Grand Slam final. Enna ended that year, 2001, ranked 7th. But although she'd established herself in the world's top 10, she then got stuck around 5 in the rankings and seemed unable to take the next step. At 1.67 m, or 5'5½", was she too small for the increasingly powerful women's game? It was two straight sets defeats in early 2003 to Kim Clijsters, her fellow Belgian to whom she gives a lot of credit for making her a better player, that triggered the spurt that took Enna to her longed-for Paris title.
I had to play against her in Belgium, in a tournament in Belgium, and it was a very bad loss. She beat me in two sets. It was in 2003, beginning of the year. And I remember after that match, and we were in Dubai with my coach talking about, okay, how can we improve, how we can deal more better with this kind of situation. And I think it's been a very important of my career. As I say, okay, I'm a good tennis player. I was maybe 5 or 6 in the world, but my goal is to be number one, and I have to get better mentally and emotionally. And how did I do that? I decided to work also harder physically, so I could get better mentally after that. And that loss against Kim in Belgium in front of our crowd has been something that really pushed myself to say, okay, now I have to go to the next step.
She won that tournament in Dubai, then followed up with titles in Charleston and Berlin before arriving in Paris. The big obstacle was her semi-final against the defending champion Serena Williams, a home match for Enna, as hundreds of Belgian fans drove across northern France to support her. It was a nerve-wracking contest, not without controversy, but Enna won in 3 sets. Waiting for her in the final was her compatriot and rival, Clijsters. Enna was ruthless, winning 6-love, 6-4 to seal her reward for those years of dedication she put down to destiny and a bit of craziness. She'd honoured the promise she'd made to her late mother 11 years earlier and went on to win Roland Garros 3 more times. For several years, she was the player to beat on clay.
It was a love story, I would say, almost between Roland Garros and I, because I was there when I was 10 years old, because it was the first tournament I was watching on TV. It was just my dream. French Open was my dream. So as soon as I was there, there was something very special I was feeling, like I was at home, the pressure was high. Yeah, I was there in almost like I had the keys of my house. And I had very difficult moments. Two or three times in the French Open, I didn't play well. It was very difficult. But it will forever remain something very special. I don't know if I can say it's my favorite tournament, because there are so many other tournaments that are great tournaments. I can talk about the Australian Open, for example. I really love to play there, but in my heart, in my emotions, the French Open was just the best.
The great Justine Enna, ending Chris Bowers' look at three Hall of Famers from the past 50 years who all had to show great dedication in their different ways to reach the ultimate goal they had set themselves. And in doing so, provided great drama for the world to enjoy. For more in this series, you can go to tennisfame.com/podcast and choose from a wide selection of interviews and discussions involving the great names of tennis. I'm Patrick McEnroe, and thanks for listening to the Tennis Worthy Podcast. You can listen at any time. I'm sure there must be a podcast or two that you missed that you can catch up on. And we'll have more fascinating content for you in a couple of weeks.